morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Wednesday, February 19th. There are several items on our agenda. We will start with the public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1528A, Legislative Revenue Office.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1528A is the annual reconnect bill that this committee sees each session, both the long and the short session. And it is the bill that's updating our connection point to federal statute. So just as a very brief refresher on how Oregon connects, again, there's primarily two categories in which you can view how Oregon connects to federal statute. The first is what we call our rolling reconnect, which is our connection to the federal definition of taxable income. And you can think of that as Oregon's tax system, begins with that definition of federal taxable income. So any changes made or anything incorporated in that federal definition automatically is within our tax system here in Oregon. So any changes made at the federal level related to taxable income are here in Oregon. That policy is made here for Oregon. So the question then becomes, does Oregon want to disconnect from anything in that definition of taxable income? The second category, and what's primarily in the bill in front of you here, is these point-in-time connections. So Oregon also has, in addition to the definition of taxable income connection, we have that point-in-time connection where a specific date in statute, in federal statute, is selected for where Oregon connects. So the standard language usually uses a December 31st connection point. And you can almost think of it, if you printed out, say, the Internal Revenue Code on December 31st, 2018, that's what Oregon's connected to right now. And then if you printed out, what does it say on December 31st, 2019, that would be our new connection point. And for the most part, those two printouts are going to be exactly the same. It's any changes that happened over the course of the year that would be the changes that Oregon's now connecting to by moving that date up by 1 year. And we do have the Oregon Society of CPAs that'll be discussing what those changes were over this past year. They have a background document in OLS as well. But so I won't go into too much detail on any of the federal changes other than just highlighting two things specifically that are also in the SMS. And I would note there's also a section contents, as this is a rather long bill, there's a section by section description of the bill. This is something you see as well each of the sessions. But the two things that I would highlight are changes. The first one is responding to a change at the federal level related to 529 higher education savings plans. And so Oregon, as some of you will remember from last session, Oregon moved from a subtraction to a tax credit to incentivize those savings. So Oregon is adopting two provisions made at the federal level of how you can essentially spend that money in that higher education savings account. So the first would be expenses associated with the registered apprenticeship program. Those would now be allowed along with interest and principal on qualified education loans up to $10,000. And again, these are both provisions that were made at the federal level that Oregon is then specifically adopting to those changes here. And the second is, and you'll hear more background on this, but there was a number of updates at the federal level or changes made related to tax incentivized savings for retirement. So specifically in the bill in front of you, you see there's a number of connections there, sections 1A to 12 related to PERS plans. And so that is incorporating the changes at the federal level into Oregon statutes. Now, of course, the federal statutes are the controlling statutes, so the policy decision has already been made. This is just updating Oregon statute to then align so that they read the same, really. But again, those are the two specific things I wanted to point out. And then we do have the testimony in OLS and forthcoming from the Oregon Society of CPAs as well.
Thank you. Are there any questions before we go to public hearing? If not, then we will call the two individuals who have signed up representing the CPAs. Always a day we look forward to is hearing your analysis. And that's Gary Holcomb and Heather Jackson. I understand Heather may be on her way, so when she enters the room, we'll invite her to join you. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your expertise.
I am scheduled to go first, so it works out okay.
That's great. Go for it.
Good
Good morning, Vice Chair Marsh and Vice Chair Reschke. My name is Gary Holcomb. I'm a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs Taxation Committee. I'm a certified public accountant in public practice in Portland, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of over 4,400 members of the OSCPA, and we respectively testify to reconnect in the federal legislative analysis. Thank you for having us again this year. On December 20th, 2019, there were two acts that were passed as part of the Federal Further Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2020. These two acts were the Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement, which would be the SECURE Act, and then the Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Relief Act of 2019, and which we'll refer to as the Disaster Act, and the first one as the SECURE Act. What we've done this year is we've attempted to break down the changes into the five recommendations, similar to how we've done in prior years. And just as a reminder, our primary objective is to be a technical resource to the legislature, and secondarily, to promote taxpayer compliance by striving to keep Oregon law tied to the IRS code. Oregon's permanent connection only applies to the definition of taxable income, as legislative revenue staff pointed out. Oregon has permanently been connected to federal taxable income since January 1, 2011. We support rolling reconnect whether the tax implications of the taxpayer is increased or decreased taxation. Exemptions to this connection is that there are certain ones already that you have made a policy choice on, such as the 199A deduction in certain 529 plans and in prior years, which you did. Although one disconnect does not have a large impact to taxpayer compliance, many different exemptions or different connection dates can have an impact to taxpayer compliance and subsequently cost Oregon to issue notices and perform audits. This presentation will cover important items in A, B, the five categories. A through D are really the SECURE Act, and then E and F are the Disaster Act provisions when we're covering these. We're skipping a number of items. There's a lot to go through again this year, so we'll be skipping them and just trying to point out some of the ones we thought may be more relevant. But, you know, please ask any questions at any time, and we'll hopefully Heather or I will be able to answer those. So again, similar to what legislative revenue staff had indicated, our recommendation keys are divided into these five categories this year. You'll see six, but we don't have any Cs this year. So A are those just general reconnects. So it's anything that will just automatically, by the permanent connection to federal taxable income, these items will just do it unless you guys make a different policy choice. The items that we are categorizing in subcategory B are those items that just don't need a change in Oregon. Those would be, you know, typically those are things like credits and other items that just don't impact taxable income. Then in D, there are some provisions that will reference the tax code but don't necessarily impact taxable income. That could be, you know, FAA authorization and things like that that don't. And then the last two are the two that I mentioned that Heather will be covering, and Section E are all the ones that were passed as part of the Disaster Act, and then F are those that have expired that were and then extended as part of the extenders package, which Congress normally does the extenders, which they've done for a number of years. So before I jump into my recommendations A, I'll let Heather jump in.
Alrighty. Good morning, Chair Nathanson. Sapson, Vice Chair Marsh and Vice Chair Reschke, and member of the House Committee. Excuse me. For the record, my name is Heather Jackson. I'm a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm here as a public accountant, and I appreciate the time.
All right. So, there, I'm scrolling now. Again, I'm not going to cover these page by page. As we mentioned, the SECURE Act, obviously, it's retirement, mostly retirement related, and a lot of these provisions, you know, we're connecting to because it may impact how your retirement. It doesn't necessarily impact tax, but it may impact how the retirement plan works and is administered, and therefore, in the end, it does connect to federal taxable income. Right, so if you can or cannot participate, or if certain things are enhanced or not enhanced, will depend on that'll impact you at the end. So, one of the first ones, maybe just to give you an example. There, I'm scrolling. is like the second one on this page is certain non-tuition fellowship programs. So you would think that they're allowing it to be includable and taxable in income for determining how much a student could contribute to an IRA, because you have to make so much in order to contribute. But it doesn't necessarily include it in that student's taxable income. So it's allowing more students who are in fellowships to increase their contributions to IRAs for future. So you'll see a lot of provisions like that. Like the next one is, you know, that you'll see in this page is the maximum age for retirement contributions. You can now contribute to an IRA even past the age of 70 and a half. Again, most of these, like on page 9 and 10, are, you know, administrative provisions about, you know, how you can treat loans and how you can treat certain items. One that may be interesting is this on top of page 12 is who is allowed to be in certain retirement plans. And this one expanded part-time workers. It allowed part-time workers that worked 500 hours or more per year, as long as they've worked 3 consecutive years, to participate in a retirement plan instead of at 1,000 hours. So again, it's kind of loosened those requirements about who can or who can't participate. On page 14, there's one here that's related to if someone's providing foster care for certain individuals. Again, this is an example similar to those student, the student one. They're able to treat those payments as compensation, which allows them to participate more in the IRAs, but it doesn't then, by treating it as compensation for them, it doesn't increase their tax. It doesn't become part of taxable income. It just was part of their retirement plan. On page 15 is what before when you if any employer made a change to their plan, they had to make it by the beginning of the year, by the beginning of the calendar year. And now this allows you, you may elect back to the beginning of your taxable year, just as long as you're do it by the end of your filing. So similar to those other two I discussed on page 16, there's some benefits of volunteer firefighters and emergency medical responders, some enhancements for them about it, what's excluded for gross income purposes for them. And I think that's it. I mean, there's a lot of administrative provisions in here, so, but it's all related to kind of how plans are administered. And as Legislative Council mentioned, you know, some of the implications to PERS and things. I'll do that, Heather, and you want to do B?
Okay. Any questions so far? Alrighty. As a reminder, B is no change necessary by Oregon. Most of these are credits, administrative rules, or other provisions that don't even affect Oregon at all. Page 20 to 23 covers credits, penalty-free withdrawals from retirement plans for birth or adoption of a child, combined annual reporting for group plans, and increasing various penalties through the IRS code. On page 24, they talk about the kiddie tax changes, and under the new law, starting January 1st, 2018, the kiddie tax had their own set of taxes. They were taxed at a higher rate, closer to the trust rates. They've now taken that away, and we're back to the regular kiddie tax rules for the most part, starting January 1, 2020. That kind of covers Section B in a very quick nutshell, but just let you know what's going on there. We had no recommendations, as a reminder, for Section C, which means there was something Oregon needed to do or at least look at with some detail. So on to Section D. So Section D is, these reference the tax code, but they actually don't have a tax law change. These ones on these three, there's three of them on pages 27, 28. These are a change to disclosures, fiduciary safe harbor rules, and premiums that they can charge. I mean, pretty basic ones. Any questions? That's basically the SECURE Act in a very quick nutshell. So Section E, we tried a bit of a different presentation for all the what we call extenders. So Section E, as Gary had mentioned, is all the things that got extended or have been extended under the old law that started in 2018 for a 10-year period. So this is like a quick reference of all of the code sections and their right now due date or expiration date. Some of them that are permanently extended are noted as that. So it's just a very quick reference. Section F is the things that have expired in the last couple of years. They have, most of them were in 2017, December 31st of 2017, they expired. There was one of 2018. But again, it's just a quick reference to kind of where the extenders are. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
All right.
All righty.
Smith didn't alert me to any question that he might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We need to cover for this bill before I close the public hearing. And there's no one else here to testify on Senate Bill 1528A. I'm closing the public hearing. Representative Smith, I want to allow an opportunity. Did you have any questions for that panel?
I did not.
Thank you.
You're awesome.
Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 1528A. We'll be at ease for just a few seconds for me to coordinate with Legislative Revenue Office. I'm opening a work session now on House Bill 4164. Mr. Alano.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As the committee heard this the other day, House Bill 4164 is being considered with a -1 amendment. And what the bill does is it increases the maximum rate that a metropolitan service district may impose from 1% to 2%. The dash amendment does two things. The main thing is to move the effective date of the cap increase to ordinances approved on or after May 1st, 2020. It also has language around allowing a service district to enter into contracts and agreements with other entities or governments. And you do have the fiscal and the revenue impact statements. Mm-hmm. No revenue impact, and the fiscal impact just mentions they reached out to Metro.
Okay. Chair Nathanson, I move the -1 amendment be adopted into House Bill 4164. Representative Marsh moves the -1 amendment adopted into House Bill 4164. Any discussion? And this is on the amendment. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passes. Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 4164 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Marsh moves House Bill 4164 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be a no on the bill amended just because I don't believe that we can tax our way into affordable housing. I think there's other mechanisms that we need to explore, and so I'll be a no on the bill.
Any other discussion? Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, so I've been really working through this bill in my own mind, and I'll just give some of my thoughts out loud. I support that it going to the vote of the people for the tax. So any tax that comes to the state of Oregon, I hope it goes to a vote. Where I'm confused is what the amount or who will be actually taxed. So we're not clear in here. I know that's not my decision space, but we don't know what segment of the income will be taxed. That weighs in whether the bill will pass or not, or the vote will pass. So for that unclarity, I'll be a no vote.
Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to explain why I'll be a yes vote. I do know that voters are being asked to support things in their community, and there are a limited number of tools. They've tended to fall on property owners, payroll tax for people at all income levels who are earning an income. I am supporting this tax because I think that it puts more tools on the table for local government to decide how they kind of balance out where the tax burden falls on people. So I'm doing it to try to unshackle local governments and get state a little bit out of the way. And I also just want to say I'm very eager to work with my colleague, Representative Reschke, on other ideas to support housing.
Thank you. Any other discussion on 4164?
Any objections?
Objections. You need to, yeah.
Oh, somebody will object. Sorry, process new.
Just helping, yeah.
Tricky.
Thank you. We have two objections. Motion passes.
Thank you, Chair.
I will assign a carrier before the end of the meeting, so I will not close the work session yet. Or can I? All right. And I'll let you know by the end of the meeting. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 4164. And we're at ease for another minute while we...
Thank you.
We're no longer at ease, but it sounds like people in the hall are having a fine time.
They're very at ease.
They're very at ease, yes, thank you. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 4009. Mr. Allenack, what do we have ready for House Bill 4009?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for 4009, the main amendment is the Dash 16, which is a combination largely of the Dash of previous amendments that have been discussed, a couple of previous amendments, I think the Dash 10 and Dash 13. So there is a cheat sheet in there under meeting material, House Bill 4009 with the Dash 16s. And so just to refer to that, that first part just identifies what's in the base bill. And then the table touches on the changes that are in the amendment along with just where they are, just to help people find precise language. Most of these should be familiar, although there are a couple of differences. The business revenue to commercial activity and the tax refunds have been discussed before. Something new that is in the bill or in the amendment is the manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperatives. These were nonprofits that were missed in the initial bill in 2019. Getting back to the base of the tax, one of the decisions there was to have nonprofits excluded from the tax. And these were a set of nonprofits that had been missed, so they're added now so that they would not be subject to the tax. The next few items are, as expected, the unrelated business income is unchanged, the foreign entities without commercial activity, that's unchanged, and then the returns and allowances and the subtraction calculation are as previously discussed. The penalties have been modified a little bit. They are still a 5% along with the safe harbor. What got removed was this idea of for 2020 having taxpayers refer to 2019. There was prior language on the penalties that tried to introduce a safe harbor for the first year, but that actually just created more problems than it solved by referring to 2019 when the tax wasn't in place. So it just created an awkwardness, so that got removed. And then one thing that is not in the Dash 16s was there was language around vehicle dealers, and it deleted language around specific customers, and that got removed. And I think those are the highlights from basically combining those amendments into a single amendment for ease of reference.
So, committee, we don't have paperwork finished. So we will not be taking motions on this, but this would be a good time for you to ask questions or have discussion on this amendment. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chris, there was a dash six amendment for, I believe it was six or seven dairy farmers that were not part of co-ops to be excluded from the tax. And I was wondering if that is in the dash 16s or not.
That is not in the dash 16. The dash six, so there are other amendments posted on OLS. Yeah. And this is intended to be a mutually exclusive list of amendments. So like the dash three and the dash six are not in the dash.
As well as the dash 12 is mutually exclusive.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay.
Correct.
All right, thank you.
They stand on their own.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions about this amendment, dash 16? That means we're finished with our discussion of House Bill 4009 for today. Is this posted for our next meeting, or will I carry this over?
Let me just confirm. I do not believe it's posted for tomorrow afternoon's meeting at 5:30. It is not. You can carry it over if you like. We can also just repost. We're within the time frame. We just have to do that today by 5:30. For the 24 hours.
That's what we're going to do for now. My intent is to post this for tomorrow.
And we do have the paperwork on track to gear it up for tomorrow.
Okay. My intent is to post for tomorrow. I do not need to carry this over, so I'm closing today's work session on House Bill 4009. And now, the last item to cover on our agenda, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 4010. And we do not have paperwork for this one either, but there are some new amendments that have just been posted. I would like Legislative Revenue Office to do a brief review again of how the benefits accrue for Oregon taxpayers.
Okay. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I will start with a brief description of the benefits, like the chair stated. And on OLIS, I posted just a one slide description of these benefits. I think we'll get that pulled up in a second. But we've been trying, our office has been thinking about this in terms of two benefits. That's a simpler way to view it. Benefit one is the initial deferral. Benefit two is the final exclusion. So one thing that's really important here with the deferral is that even though you don't pay tax on this today, you are required to pay tax on that initial investment at some point. The latest date that you can pay tax on that initial investment is December 31st, 2026. That's in the IRC code that establishes this program. So the initial deferral, you do pay tax on that amount. You do pay tax on that eventually. If you hold it for 5 years, then you get this 10% of initial investment. And if you had the investment for 7 years, you get 15% of initial investment step up in basis. So at least 85% of that initial investment is taxable by the end of 2026. So that's the deferral. The second benefit is the final exclusion, and this is the one that effectively avoids capital gains taxation if you hold the investment for 10 years. So if the investment is held for at least 10 years, upon sale, whatever the sale price of the asset is, the basis is stepped up to equal that. And so effectively, you have no capital gains as defined under the program. So again, we've just tried to think about this as benefit one versus benefit two. The initial deferral, it's a deferral, so you do pay tax on it eventually, just not today. And the exclusion, this is the one where as we are automatically connected, and so in the absence of legislation, this would you would be able to avoid capital gains taxation. So initial deferral, you do pay tax on that eventually. Final exclusion, you could avoid taxation. And then, as the chair mentioned, there are three amendments now posted to OLIS that were posted very recently this morning. I'm going to briefly describe each of those amendments and how they relate to the introduced version of the bill. And so if we could pull up the SMS, then I think the committee can see these. The dash six replaces the bill, so it's a gut and stuff, and it establishes reporting requirements. So currently, in the absence of the dash six, there's no requirement for funds to report to the state about the activity. So the dash six establishes an initial reporting requirement within 6 months of either receiving money from an Oregonian investor or investing in an Oregon Opportunity Zone, and then annual reporting thereafter. It gives the Department of Consumer and Business Services rulemaking authority to address those reporting requirements. And so the dash six, really, we're thinking of this as kind of a reporting requirement amendment. The dash seven amends the introduced version by allowing only a 50% increase in basis upon sale. So when we were talking previously about the two benefits, this is amending the second benefit, that final exclusion. So rather than getting the full step up in basis of 100%, the dash seven would mean that in Oregon, you only get 50% of that step up in basis. It does not affect the federal treatment of the investment. And then the seven makes a couple clarifying changes to which sections of the IRC that it's referring to. Those are really technical changes here. And then in the dash eight, this removes the disconnect from the introduced version of the bill. So the dash eight deletes the provisions that disconnect Oregon from the federal tie. So effectively, the dash eight requires LRO to do a study examining these zones and potential connection options. So those are the three amendments. And of course, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for reviewing all of that. If all the amendments are adopted that were just described, the way I would describe the net result of our actions would be for opportunity zones, we stay connected, we reduce the Oregon tax benefit, we do a study, and we add transparency. Basically, four components to the action from the amendments that were just described today. So we're open for discussion or questions to further clarify what's going on with those amendments. Representative Kenny Guy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, because the dash one originally had dealt with retroactivity. I'm assuming that the what's on the table now is at this point going forward, and anyone who had invested in the past would be staying to the old rules. Is that correct?
So Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Guyer. So I believe in the dash seven, I think a little technical because of the timing of the exclusion.
Uh-huh.
So because the timing of the exclusion event happens in the future, mm-hmm. Anyone that reaches that 10-year mark in the future would get this, would be affected by the disconnect. So effectively, my understanding is that if you invested in 2018, mm-hmm. the dash seven would mean that after holding this for 10 years in 2028 and then selling the asset, you would still be affected by this 50% increase in basis because that event takes place in the future.
Thank you for that clarification.
Other questions? Any other discussion?
Just Madam Chair, you said the paperwork wasn't ready, so you're going to do with this bill as we did with 4009, correct?
That's right.
Okay, that was going to be my ask, just so I have some time to study it, because I know the dash 8 dropped at 8:32 this morning. So while I am a voracious speed reader, my comprehension may be a little lacking. So I can get through the words, but I have to understand it, so I appreciate the time.
Anything else? Well, it appears that our work is done for today on this bill. And for this, also, my intent is to post a work session don't need to do an official we're carrying this over because we will post a work session. So for today, I'm closing the work session on 4010. There's no other business, right? We're done. Thank you, everyone. We're adjourned. Just in time for you all.
Have a good day, my friend.